Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast brought to you by Engelsberg Ideas, where we take ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined today by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at EI. And today, we're going to talk about strategy, resilience, and defence, especially in light of the recent London Defence Conference, which was held on 23rd and 24th of May. Now, despite the war in Ukraine and China's growing challenge to the West, attending the London Defence Conference made me realise just how little themes of strategy, resilience, and defence are discussed with any seriousness or depth by British media outlets, not least the BBC. So it was refreshing and occasionally unsettling, I have to say, to see these crucial issues raised and debated so incisively and, it has to be said, quite frankly. Now, Alistair, you were also at the London Defence Conference. What did you take from it? Quite a lot, I presume.
I thought that my main takeaway was that the link between our policy preferences and the kind of strategic heft with which to pursue them was very closely aligned. And there was a kind of pragmatism about the conversation, especially in light of a resurgent Russia and China, which seems to be a fearsome competitor.
Yes, that does seem to be a real shift that I noticed as well from what we might call, say, 20 years ago, perhaps further back, an idealistic foreign policy outlook to one that's much more pragmatic. And I think this was marked by what we might call the return of history.
Yeah, if you think about, you know, if we held a conference 20 years ago on defence in 2003, when I was a mere 8 years old, so I'm going to have to, read the runes a little bit on that, you know, it would have been dominated by the question of radical Islam. And it would have been, you know, there would have been murmurs about Washington's increased willingness to use force in the Middle East. And there would have been a broad, if you look at the kind of policy discussion of that period, everything is rooted around the global war on terror, which was then reframed as the long war in 2006 by US policymakers, which is less a strategy than a kind of description, than a kind of policy prescription. And when it was applied in the real world in interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, we very quickly realised that the language was not necessarily matching up with reality. You know, there was no consideration of what we were actually doing on a regional level. Indeed, some of the things we did in this global war on terror, in fact, fostered conditions for more terror as we collided with local sensitivities, local histories, complex things that we didn't quite understand and were not captured by the kind of policy language of the time. And even if you look 20 years ago, you know, we would have been talking about hope for China, about China within the global trading system. And we would have also talked about Russia in very different terms. We would have talked about Putin's willingness to engage on issues like international terrorism. So everything got folded into this kind of big sweeping language, which wasn't necessarily matched with what we were doing.
And as recently as the Cameron-Osborne government, we saw them really go out of their way to attract China in terms of investment. They saw China as very much the future there, and that has been completely transformed.
Yeah, exactly. And I felt that at the conference, which took in a huge range of themes from the battlefield to space to AI, with a range of brilliant speakers, that there was this sense that strategy in its most basic form is back. And what do we mean by strategy? I mean, I think it was Clausewitz who said that strategy was about how you win the battle that enables you to then win the war. You know, we take a very, very slimmed down description, and I think that's actually quite illuminating. We have many battles to fight, and maybe in the last couple of decades we weren't quite clear what those battles were for. And we also weren't clear about what the war was in which we were fighting, as illustrated by the kind of bloviating about civilizational conflicts that was pretty unmoored.
And I think that reached, I would argue, its nadir with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And the whole debate, everything from the Second Gulf War on to the African withdrawal, also had the effect of poisoning domestic politics as well, in the sense that while we lost over there, something was also lost here.
Quite. And I think that you know, what was remarkable about the conference was the unanimity of support for the support we're giving to Ukraine in the conflict. And it seemed, you know, it's been Putin's dearest wish, hasn't it, that in supporting Ukraine, we follow a kind of well-worn path in European history, that the European powers get sucked into a war that they don't want, either in the Balkans or in Eastern Europe, which they then pay for in terrible material losses. This is a major anxiety for Europeans over the last couple of centuries, you know, including the First World War. But that actually isn't what's happened. We are giving tailored, meaningful support to a country that is resisting, that is engaged in a war and is resisting an oppressive force that wants to do what it wants with it. And I feel like the public support, although it's more complicated in parts of Europe, especially countries which have a much stronger relationship with Russia in terms of their economic links, in general, it hasn't poisoned the well in the way in which our interventions in, for example, the Middle East did, which our interventions in Iraq, for example, although they were framed as almost an existential conflict, you know, the public never quite bought into that, did it? Whereas with Ukraine, the stakes are obviously high. I mean, Russia, they thought that invading, you know, at first, the war was described simply as a special military operation whose aims were to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. And, you know, what followed from that was that they didn't prepare enough forces to actually fight a war. They thought it was going to be a kind of surgical strike where the kind of mass of troops would just neutralize any resistance on the ground, and that it would all be over very quickly. But they got into a war very quickly, and war is dynamic. It is a weird combination of reason, chance, emotion, all three playing a very important role, and it's a clash of wills. And when you're involved in that, it's a completely different situation.
And it was really evident to me, at least, I don't know whether it was to you, the very substantial difference in policy between Russia, which seems to have embraced an existential conflict with the West without, as you make clear, really thinking this through, whereas Ukraine's reaction to this has been marked by a very clear policy and, as you said before, this unanimity of support, because it's so much easier to back something when the policy is very clear.
Yeah, and at the moment, the policy is to push the Russian forces out, at least to the point of contact, as it was in March 2022. Beyond that, there are divisions in the Western Alliance about what victory would look like, which was very powerfully illustrated at the defence conference, I thought. You know, there is a kind of lively debate going on both here and in the US and in Europe about what victory looks like. But ultimately, that's a question for another day for Ukraine. They're doing what they have to do in the moment.
Well, what do you think victory looks like?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't like to speculate. But I think at least pushing, I think the very clear, I think it's not necessarily useful for us to speculate, but because the Ukrainians are engaged in existential war, which is inherently dynamic and inherently unstable, and whatever I say right now may not would be entirely unhelpful to make predictions. But what I can say is that Ukraine has to at least push the Russians back to the point of contact, which would be, number one, a major propaganda win for Ukraine. And would very much potentially change the situation in Moscow. But yeah, it's very interesting. The Russians, they simultaneously talk about how they're in an existential war with the West, certainly in terms of their kind of media and the kind of hawks within Russia. But then they characterise Ukraine as a kind of puppet state, which has no real solidity and is a kind of something that ultimately will just fold under pressure from a cautious Washington and from the might of Russia. And that is just a kind of illusion about what is happening.
Well, let me pick up on two things there. One, we might see as positive, one potentially negative. First of all, the positive bit is this realignment within NATO that's seen in many ways, balance of power, is that the correct term? Shifting east. We learned that Poland is now spending or aims to spend something like 4% of its GDP on defence. There are ambitions for the UK, indeed, to go up to something like 2.5% potentially. So we see a shift there. But as well as Poland playing a major role now within NATO, and that seems to be the case for some years to come now, and obviously it has some kind of existential relationship historically with Russia. But we've also seen the Baltic states, especially prominent, not least in intelligence, where they played a major role. But we now also see Finland's accession to NATO, which is a huge leap considering the size of its border with Russia, absolutely crucial partner now within NATO. And of course, we have the potential accession of Sweden, though it might be worth saying that Erdogan's re-election in Turkey may complicate matters there.
You're seeing from Poland and the Baltic states and North something really interesting happening, which is the birth, I think, of the kind of strategic culture within their policymaking that you might only have once associated in Europe with France and the UK, which are key to European defence and play an outsized role in terms of their strengths and their the way their army, just the way their armies link with the kind of defence organisations of other countries. It's not that Finland hasn't always had a very robust sense of its own defence and civil defence, and has fought wars of national liberation within within living memory, with some success, with great success. It is that now these countries are thinking about how they can engage with alliances and making sovereign decisions to join alliances that embrace collective defence and link them more fully into the kind of Euro-Atlantic, to sort of jargonize a little bit, Euro-Atlantic defense community. And that, to me, is what the counter, what Russia has achieved. It's not necessarily that, Finland and Sweden have it's changed overnight, and Finland and Sweden have gone from completely non-aligned to suddenly key Western partners. It's that the systems that were already in place, the interoperability of their defense, of their militaries with other powers, is suddenly being linked to a kind of more robust thinking about Russia and defence.
Yeah, and I think that was another thing that was very interesting about the conference. I remember particularly when the Swedish defence minister spoke, he talked about the journey that Sweden has been on. You know, there's been a split between social democrats and more pro-Atlanticist politicians. It's obviously the pro-Atlanticist politicians in the ascendancy at the moment. But this is not something that's happened in Sweden overnight. It's not something that's happened in Finland overnight. A great deal of thought has been on this. It is, to use the old cliche, something of a journey. But on that idea of cooperation between NATO allies, I was really taken by Sir Tony Radakin's comments. Now, Tony Radakin is the chief of the defence staff, Admiral Sir Tony Radakin, when he talked about mass. And we tend to think of mass in military terms as being boots on the ground. But he made a very nuanced piece that, for example, in terms of the UK, it's never really historically or very rarely been one about a mass of bodies within the army. I mean, there's the old history that's deep in this country that goes back, arguably, I should know this, to the civil wars, where there's a reluctance and an antipathy towards a standing army. Britain as a naval power, all that stuff, certainly a strong intelligence power now, and it has technological advances. But this mass now is very, very different countries with differing perspectives uniting and being united by Russia's actions in Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think you would have to have been blind over the last 20 years not to cotton on to the fact that Russia has had an enormous axe to grind, especially following the end of the Cold War. What happened in the 90s in Russia, which was, to put it mildly, deeply humiliating for a country of the kind of size and historical influence of Russia. And the moment that Putin managed to consolidate the state and harness its natural resources, and, you know, what happened in the 2000s, I mean, Russia became an energy superpower, which was able to provide cheap energy to broad swathes of the planet's populace. This was always going to end up with a degree of revanchism and a degree of confidence. And, you know, we know that Russia's history in terms of its border wars is one of extraordinary violence and of, extreme sensitivity to many Russians, whether that's in the Caucasus or in the or in Ukraine or in the Baltic states. And I think, you know, it's really interesting to see the divisions within the Western alliance at the moment, where you have on the one side countries like France, which have a different view on Russia, and Germany, which again has always had a slightly different view of Russia, because I think, you know, there's an unspoken assumption in many Germans, whether they like it or not, that Eastern Europe is always going to be dominated either by Germany or Russia. And at the moment, because Germany cannot play a role as a kind of geopolitical superpower which dominates its neighbourhood for obvious historical reasons, that there's a kind of inevitability about the way in which Russia relates to Eastern Europe, which ends up in a kind of dominance of its near abroad.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say the UK government has had much criticism on the domestic front, rightly so. But I think in terms of its foreign policy, it's been relatively precise, tailored. It's played a role. It's been appreciated, I think, by its allies within NATO as well. And I couldn't help thinking while I was there, actually, that had it not been for Brexit, the alignment within the EU might be quite interesting at the moment, with the relative falling away of France and Germany, the shift to Central Europe and the East in particular. But that's a counterfactual for another day, or maybe that day has gone. But I want to just raise one negative point on this issue about Ukraine and the colossal funding that the United States has given. There's been real serious backing towards Ukraine by the United States, and there's that elephant in the room, Trump, the possible re-election of Trump. What happens then? What are the dangers there?
Well, Paul, it's going to be over in 24 hours, apparently. He's going to get everyone around the table, and it's going to be big kahunas sorting out the world.
That's encouraging news.
But no, to be serious, it does pose a major problem. And it also illuminates, again, something that, again, should be clear to any thinking person, America is a quixotic place. And it's also got a semi-quixotic relationship to its own allies. Mm. All Trump does to me, it's not exceptional. It's the fact that, you know, ultimately, of course, NATO, these alliances within which our militaries are pretty much bound up with each other, you know, is just one forum in which we have to think about defence. Mm. And that there is a kind of, there's also a political dimension, how does our civil administration link with our military? Trump's involved, that relationship becomes more dysfunctional, but it doesn't stop it being a relationship.
Yeah, no. And of course, there was much talk of the AUKUS relationship between Australia, UK and US, which was very positive. But there were concerns raised. And I suppose that the fundamental nature of this is now the US is energy independent. This is quite extraordinary for the first time in a long while. And so it doesn't have the concerns that Europe has about energy dependency. That seems to me really fundamental when it comes to the foreign policy choices that America will make in the future, or it allows it a great deal more freedom than, say, Europe has, obviously. And there was a concern about a shift to the Pacific theatre with the United States. And I think there was quite a split, I noticed, in when people were asked about the risks of China invading Taiwan. Some thought it was almost imminent, others thought it extremely unlikely. So there seems to be no real consensus on that, certainly as far as I could see at the London Defence Conference. There was one particularly incisive comment, though. There's been great concentration on Ukraine, obviously. There is this great concern of China. But Helen Thomson, always incisive commentator, professor of political economy at Cambridge and a real expert on energy, climate change, which is obviously crucial to any idea of resilience. She made the point that just before Ukraine, the West's foreign policy focus had been very much on Iran, and that had been neglected. And that seems to me to be a real concern so far as possible realignments there, Iran and Russia, obviously, but also we see the Saudis not quite as friendly towards the West as perhaps they were. Also, perhaps, you know, seeking new deals, new alignments. And that is something that's been neglected.
My kind of negative, I guess, about the conference was the following, that, you know, within this kind of language about broadly defined liberal democracies taking on authoritarian, again, broadly defined authoritarian countries across the world, and that this is the kind of new civilizational conflict that we are engaged in the long term. That language is all very well, but we need to be very clear about what is specifically dangerous about particular countries and about, you know, it's not that Iran, Russia and China are indivisible and all share the same and all pose the same problems. They don't. You know, Iran poses very, very specific problems within its neighbourhood. Russia the same, China the same, and they all have their strengths and weaknesses that, again, do not necessarily coincide. You know, much cleverer people than me will be able to analyse those things, and I'm certainly no expert on the history of Iran or indeed China or Russia, but it does seem obvious to me that within this kind of language of the democracies effectively kind of getting together, we need to be sort of very clear about what are the local issues. Iran, obviously, sees itself as a civilizational state, as a modern revolutionary state that also has an inheritance that goes back many millennia.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I think
China is sort of quite different. It also sees itself as a civilizational state, but precisely what that means in China is very, very different to what it means to
Russia. As does Russia, of course.
Exactly.
But I suppose the key difference between Iran, Russia and China is that economically, China is so entwined within the global economic order now, of quite a different level to the way in which Iran or Russia is involved in that. I mean, Russia's pretty much a pariah state now. Iran, similarly. Whereas China, whatever we think about it, whatever criticisms that are, whatever suspicions now are raised in the United States in particular, we are entwined with it. And even if there is an American policy of dislocation in some way, it's going to take decades for that to happen, if indeed it's even achievable.
Well, resilience is very expensive.
Yeah.
You know, what do we mean by resilience? I mean, actually, interestingly, the word resilience comes from watchmaking. First becomes popularized by watchmakers because it to describe a particular quality of one aspect of the mechanism of a watch, which is that you, in a watch, in the kind of, you need bits of the watch that are sufficiently flexible to move, but are sufficiently strong that they remain in place. This is what resilience means. It means a sort of thing that can be flexible when it needs to, but can be strong and resolute when it needs to be as well. But when we talk about resilient supply chains, that kind of strength and security, again, is expensive. It means shorter supply chains. It means ones that are probably focused more in our own domestic circumstances. That, you know, we're far away from that era of global trade in which lots of goods were sort of artificially cheapened by, you know, the enormous technological advances in container ships and seamless supply chains and all that. If we want to have security, economic security, that is going to be very expensive. Again, that's something that Western policymakers and politicians should be clear about.
And that's quite a contrast with China. That's quite a contrast with China, I think, is the way, in particular, in the way it has cultivated non-aligned countries, we can call them, in Africa. In particular, a new form of colonialism, one might think, which doesn't get anything like the coverage within the Western media, certainly within the British media, as I think it should. And there were several questions raised about, you know, the concentration on China, on Russia, on Iran. Okay, that's fine. But what about the rest of the world? How does that see China? How does that see the West? And in many ways, the West is losing that battle. You know, I think it was a famous quote, of course, which says, you know, when the Chinese come here, they give us an airport. When the Americans come here, they give us a lecture. And there is, again, the legacy of that supposedly idealistic foreign policy. Well, you know, not always convinced by that, but there is at least some claim to a difference there. And I don't know how ultimately they will square that circle, the West, particularly the United States, in order to attract the support of non-aligned countries, and in particular, the floating voter that is India.
I think when we're talking about China's involvement with Africa, it's not helpful. The first thing we can do is actually stop using the language of missed opportunity, you know, which attributes a degree of foresight and cleverness to Chinese planning and policymakers that they might not necessarily have. The idea being, 10, 15 years ago, while we sort of flailed around or got involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Chinese were just so brilliantly, they just understood, you know, that the opportunity was in Africa and the opportunity was in building and fostering, you know, huge economic links to unstable African countries. But this it's not a degree of prophecy and foresight in that. It's just, you know, it's just seeing the opportunity and just taking it in the present.
But it's so much easier to be opportunist in that sense if you're not a democracy, if you're the kind of autocracy that China is, than if you have debate and discussion as you have in the United States and the West.
Yeah. And also, you know, there are specific historical reasons why the Western powers, you know, struggle to make coherent geopolitical positions on Africa. You know, and, you know, that's true of France, Britain, America, for various reasons that are very clearly understood. But, you know, I was very struck every time I was speaking to someone who hails from Uganda. And although he was very critical of Chinese labourers because they'd eaten his family's cat, they had built a remarkable road system around where his family lives. Mm. And he was just enormously grateful that that happened, because you need roads to get places.
Yeah.
And, you know, you know, we probably need to move away from a language which is rooted in a kind of patronising vision of aid and to more concrete and lasting initiatives in Africa.
And also work out that legacy of imperialism as well, that centuries-long legacy of imperialism.
Exactly,
too,
which has implications for our own domestic politics.
Of course. And let's finish with one final question that was put to several of the speakers at the London Defence Conference, and that is, as the 20th century was the American century, undoubtedly the American century, is the 21st century going to be the Chinese century?
I'd like to invoke, again, Helen Thompson, who just made some brilliant contributions at the conference. But she said something which, again, really struck me, and I just thought, you know, that to me seems very true, that we tend to overplay, we tend to have this sort of view that's kind of rooted in pop psychology, that as one power increases its potency, another must inevitably decline. Everything's a zero-sum game, that China's rise must mean America's relative decline. And she commented, and I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, that isn't necessarily true. America is almost more powerful than it was in terms of its ability to influence the world order, international politics, compared to even 20 years ago, partly because of the its role within energy politics. It's now part of a troika of Saudi Arabia and Russia, which controls huge aspects of the world's energy. It's got enormous potency, extraordinary cultural vitality, but it's just a different beast, and it's going to play a slightly different role in its own neighbourhood than we may have traditionally assumed even a couple of decades ago. And, you know, we may not be talking about, I put this question to you, Paul. What was the 19th century? What was the 18th century? Mm. You know, I mean, do we talk about those centuries as the something century?
Well, I suppose the 19th century would have been the British century, in many ways. The 18th, I'll leave that to others to decide, but certainly there was no doubt that the 20th century was the American one. But I agree with you that I haven't seen the United States as a foreign policy player in a better, stronger position than this for some time. It comes down to, as we've said before, this energy independence that it has, its sheer scale, its technological advance, where all the world's major companies now seem to be American, cutting-edge universities and scientific research alike, to real military strength, deep capital markets that we see, and we see this in the way it supported Ukraine effortlessly. And it's also, I think, woken up to the dangers presented by China and other players as well in the Middle East, elsewhere. I wouldn't bet against the 21st century also being the American century. Perhaps it's one that will be shared between America and China, but I don't see America disappearing anytime soon. Quite the opposite. So thank you, Alistair, for that. I hope you enjoyed that discussion on security, defence and resilience. Some things that I think we'll be talking about much more in future with other guests. So thank you for listening to EI Talks. I'm Paul Lay. Thank you.